book of Romans, chapter 12. Romans, chapter 12. And we'll read the first three verses. We looked at verses 1 and 2 this morning. We'll look at verses 1 through verse 3. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. Again, the overall arrangement and structure of the book has is common with Paul, is first a doctrinal foundation, which he lays in chapters 1 through 11. And then personal application of the truth. And that's Paul's style of writing, and it serves as a constant reminder that all doctrinal truths have a practical side, and that practical application must have a firm foundation. And that foundation, of course, is truth. When we say that chapters 1 through 11 are doctrinal, we do not mean to imply that there are no practical applications made in those chapters, because there certainly are, especially Romans chapter 6. But the main idea and the main theme of chapters 1 through 11 is doctrinal. And in those chapters, Paul laid out very clearly the doctrinal truth of salvation by grace apart from works. And he demonstrated in a very definite way that salvation is the work of God. Then we come to chapter 12, and as we said this morning, there's a change in tone with the words, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, that ye... And those words serve as the introduction to the practical conclusion segment of this letter to the Romans. Again, the foundation is salvation by grace. Our text begins with, I beseech you, therefore. The therefore looks directly back to chapter 11, verse 33 through 36. We read those verses this morning. And it looks beyond that and looks back to the truths that Paul has been presenting. And then he summarizes these truths, as we saw this morning, under those four words, the mercies of God. That pretty much summarizes the truths, the mercies of God. Again, only as we understand, only as we receive by faith who God is and what God has done for us, can we find a right motive, can we find a right manner for serving the Lord. So it's very important that we grasp, have some comprehension of who God is, and what God has done in grace and mercy for us. Again, we're all very familiar with verses 1 and 2. But we want to take the main thought tonight from verse 3. We want to center our thoughts around those four words, the measure of faith. And we see that there is a connection between this measure of faith and the duty that is stated in verses 1 and 2. So I want to speak tonight on the importance of our stature of faith. Again, in verses 1 and 2, a plea goes forth. For the saved by grace, to do that which is reasonable, to do something in light of the mercies of God. And what he's calling upon us to do is the complete surrender and setting apart of self to God for his use, and then to live life separate and apart from the world in devotion and in commitment to God. That is to be our life. Verse 3, notice, opens with the word for, meaning with respect to, referring back to the duty and obligation stated in verses 1 and 2. Now notice what he says. He says, "For I say through," that is, by means or agency of the grace, the favor given. And if it's grace, it must be bestowed freely unto me to, speaking of who he is speaking to every man. And then notice what it says, that is among you. So he's speaking of an assembly. He's speaking to an assembly. He's speaking to a group, to every man among you. That's a group. The personal duty and obligation that is being pleaded for in verse 1 and 2 certainly involves all children of God. But I believe here he is speaking to a local congregation. And certainly we individually must do what is stated in verses 1 and 2. And certainly it applies to us as a congregation as well. Now, what is stated in verses 1 and 2 involves losing sight of ourselves and being completely absorbed with God. What is stated in verses 1 and 2, is, as we saw this morning, is to be voluntary. It is to be carried out with a spirit of readiness. It is to be carried out with a spirit of cheerfulness. That is seen in that word, present. That is, it is something that we ought to want to do. This is not something that we ought to fight against. This is something in light of the mercies of God that we want to do. We ought to view it as it is the least that I can do. In light of God's mercies to me, the least that I can do is surrender myself to Him. So what is stated in verses 1 and 2 involves surrender. We've already seen that that surrender is to be continual. It is to be entire. That you present your bodies a living sacrifice. But we see also that what is stated in verses 1 and 2 involves a personal and continual separation from the world. We are not to be conformed to the world. That is, there is to be a resistance. There is to be a resistance of the world's philosophies. We're to resist the reasonings of the world. We're to resist the ways and the pursuits and the ideas of the world. And we see that there's to be a continual transformation being made in our lives. That is, continually our lives are to be being altered. Continually there needs to be a conversion going on in our lives. There needs to be an overhaul going on in our lives, a reconstruction, a remaking. And this is all done through a restoration of the mind. We see there in verse 2. Now in verse 3, he mentions a danger or a hindrance. A hindrance to accomplishing verses 1 and 2. He says, "I say to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. With those words, Paul is addressing an issue that will certainly prevent us from living in verses 1 and 2. No man think of himself more highly than he ought to think. The elevation of self is what gets in the way more than anything else. It's what gets in the way of verses 1 and 2. The elevation of self in one's mind is in direct opposition to everything that is stated in verses 1 and 2. Sinful pride will keep us out of verses 1 and 2. What Paul is speaking of, and keep in mind, that he is speaking still in a pleading fashion. I beseech you, he says. He is still pleading. He is now pleading with them not to be overcome with pride, because it will certainly keep you from that reasonable service. The inward thought of superiority, a high opinion of one's worth, a feeling of preeminence, it's sin, and it will prevent us from accomplishing verses 1 and 2. Pride, whether it be inward or outward, is sin. As sin, it is an act of opposition and rebellion against God. The truth is, pride is the most universal of all sin. It is behind every sin. I believe if you dissect sin, you will find the sin of pride in every single sin. Sin is an abomination. We are told in Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 19, in Proverbs 16 and verse 5. It is an abomination. What that means is it is an object of extreme disgust and hatred by God. God is disgusted by pride. God hates pride. In fact, pride is the most heinous of all sin. I mean, you really start dissecting pride, and it is the most heinous of all sin. It is the most destructive of all sin. It has devastating results. In Mark chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, Jesus mentions it as one of the things that defile an individual. We read in Daniel chapter 5 and verse 20 concerning Belshazzar that his heart and his mind was, his heart was lifted up and his mind was hardened in pride. An individual that has been hardened in pride will not surrender to God, will not see a need to surrender to God. An individual who is proud will see absolutely no need to lay themselves on the altar of sacrifice. An individual who is proud is going to have a very difficult time acknowledging God's absolute claim and rights upon their lives. In Obadiah chapter 3, we read, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee." Perhaps the most deceiving of all sin is the sin of pride. Pride is a hindrance to seeking God. Psalm 10 and verse 4, "The wicked through the pride of his countenance, will not seek after God. God is not in his thoughts. Pride is a hindrance to being in the will of the Lord. The language of pride is like that of Pharaoh in Exodus 5 and verse 2. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Pride. 2 Timothy 3, pride is in the form of self-love is the chief contributing factor to the perilous times. Why? Because it leads to contempt. It leads to rejection of God. It leads to contempt and rejection of God's message. Pride is a hindrance to hearing the Word of God. Pride is a hindrance to applying the preached Word of God. We read in James 1 in verse 21 that we are to receive with meekness the engrafted Word. That's the only way it can be received. Pride brings shame and disgrace. Proverbs 11 and verse 2, when pride cometh, then cometh shame. And it's destructive. In Proverbs 16 and verse 18, pride goeth before destruction. So Paul here in verse 3 presents something that stands in the way of you and I doing our reasonable service, of presenting ourselves a living sacrifice. The elevation of self will prevent us and will keep us out of verses 1 and 2. Then he goes on and he mentions something that is vitally necessary. If we're going to live in verses 1 and 2, if we're going to obey that plea, there is something that is absolutely necessary. So he says here in verse 3, for I say, again by way of pleading, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. And then we see that word, but. On the other hand, to think soberly. To think soberly. Rather than the sinful thinking of pride, which is an intoxication with self. To be sober is the opposite of being intoxicated. We're to think soberly. That is, our minds are not to be intoxicated. And in the context here, our minds are not to be intoxicated with self, because it'll keep us out of verses 1 and 2. Think soberly. This is absolutely necessary if we're going to live the life of verses 1 and 2. That's why he mentioned in verse 2 concerning the renewing of our minds. To think soberly conveys the idea of clear and unclouded thinking. It is thinking that is sensible. It is thinking that is rational. And any thinking that keeps you out of verses 1 and 2, any thinking that runs contrary to verses 1 and 2, is not sensible. It is not rational. Not in light of the mercies of God. To think soberly carries the idea of no nonsense. So what is being said here is said in contrast to thinking more highly than we ought to think of ourselves. A proud state of mind does not think clearly. A proud state of mind is not sensible. A proud state of mind is not rational. And a proud state of mind is really a bunch of nonsense. It's foolishness. Any kind of thinking that prevents you and I from living in verses 1 and 2 is not sober thinking. But instead, it is a state of intoxication. Now think about intoxication. It's extremely dangerous to live life intoxicated. It is extremely harmful. It is dangerous and it is harmful to yourself. And it is dangerous and harmful to everyone who is anywhere near you. This is also true spiritually. Those who are in live their life in a state of intoxication spiritually are a danger to themselves. And they are a danger to others. You say, well, I'm not intoxicated. Well, there's a way to find out. How much do you identify with verses 1 and 2? If you do not identify with verses 1 and 2, it is because you think more highly of yourself than you ought to. In other words, you're intoxicated with self and you're not thinking right. So there's a lot of people who are intoxicated. And may I say, this form of intoxication is really worse and more destructive than any other form of intoxication. Sober thinking, which is right thinking, will cause you to see your need of living in verses 1 and 2. I mean, if you can't even see the need, you read verses 1 and 2, and you can't see, and you can't feel. There's a need. You're not thinking right. I mean, reading those verses, immediately you ought to be able to see there's a need. There is a need for me to be a living sacrifice to God. So sober thinking causes us to see the need of living in verses 1 and 2. It also fills us with the desire to live in verses 1 and 2. If we have no desire to live in verses 1 and 2, it's because we're not thinking soberly. It's because we're intoxicated with self. Any other thinking other than think soberly is delusional. It's delusional. It's false. It's wrong. And it keeps you out of verses 1 and 2. If we do not live in verses 1 and 2, our thinking is messed up. Our thinking is messed up and we are living in a state of intoxication. So to think soberly is an absolute necessity if we're going to live verses 1 and 2. Which brings us to another necessity. Again, verse 3, "For I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think." So there's a danger. There's a hindrance there. "But rather than thinking highly of self, we are to think soberly according as," or "in accord with." So a connection is about to be made between thinking soberly and something else. "According as God hath dealt to every man, which in this case would be the brethren, the called of the Lord Jesus Christ, the beloved of God, the called to be saints, the vessels of mercy, as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. Sober thinking is absolutely necessary to live life in verses 1 and 2. And we now see this sober thinking is connected, is in harmony with the measure of faith. Faith. From this, we see that a lack of faith produces wrong thinking. If sober thinking is connected to faith, then wrong thinking or intoxicated thinking means there isn't faith. This lack of faith produces wrong thinking, which results in the failure to live in verses 1 and 2. So this faith is absolutely essential to sober thinking. Sober thinking is absolutely essential to living in verses 1 and 2. Faith is absolutely essential to living in verses 1 and 2. This is why we have to get pride out of the way. Pride does not live by faith. Pride lives by sight. Pride is self-sufficient. Pride doesn't need God in their mind. So this faith is essential. Faith is dependence and reliance upon God. Again, we see the hindrance here of pride. If you believe that you are self-sufficient, you are not going to depend on anybody but yourself. So pride has to be out of the way. Then we begin to think right, which is to live by faith, to depend and to rely upon God. Faith is leaning upon God. Faith is trusting God. Faith is resting upon God. Faith is cleaving to God. It's looking to God. It's coming to God. Faith means that we flee to God. We cast ourselves upon Him. Pride works against all of these things. Pride is the enemy of faith. If we're going to think soberly, it is in harmony with faith. And it's only as we think soberly, and that's in harmony with faith, that we live in verses 1 and 2. So you can't just read verses 1 and 2 and say, I'm going to do that. It doesn't work that way. You have to get rid of pride in order to think right. And your thinking, and this thinking soberly, is in harmony with faith. If you do not have faith, you cannot live in verses 1 and 2. Because if you do not have faith, you don't think right. If you don't trust God, you don't think right. If you don't trust God, you don't live right. Faith is essential. This is why we read in Hebrews 11, without faith, it is impossible to please God. So this isn't something that you just decide, I'm going to do. I'm going to present myself to God. I'm going to go forward in church, and I'm going to make it known that I'm presenting myself to God. But you have to get rid of all the filthy pride first. And you have to have faith. Because you have to think soberly in order to live in verses 1 and 2. You see, faith is living in the reality of God. And the more you and I live in the reality of God, the more we see our need of laying ourselves upon the altar of sacrifice. Faith is letting go. It's letting go. And the reason, one of the reasons folks do not present themselves unto God is because they don't let go. They're always holding on to something, and we all do. Faith is seeing God. Faith can see God. Faith embraces God. Faith believes and acts upon what is believed. It is believing and acting upon who God is. It is believing and acting upon the omnipotence of God, the omnipresence of God, the omniscience of God. We say, oh yes, I believe in the omniscience of God. I believe in the omnipotence of God, but we don't trust Him. Well, that's not acting upon what we say that we believe. I believe God knows all things. I believe God is working all things according to His will, but I've got to figure it out. That's not faith. Faith is letting go, believing and acting upon the sovereignty of God. It is to the extent that we do these things, lean upon God, trust God, draw from God, that manifests our measure of faith. It's really not difficult. It's painful, but it's not difficult to measure our faith. There are many tests. And one of the best tests is Romans 12, 1 and 2. Do you have faith enough to present yourselves a living sacrifice unto God? Our text declares again that we must think soberly in order to fulfill our reasonable service. And one's thinking is determined by their measure of faith. We see that our degree of dedication, our degree of surrender to God, our degree of nonconformity to the world, our degree of transforming is in harmony with faith. The quality of spiritual life, our degree of living for the Lord, our following the Lord, our prayer life, our love for the Lord, our enjoyment of the Lord, our peace, our assurance, our zeal, our endurance in the Lord's cause, our keeping ourselves in our proper place in the body, which he mentioned, begins to mention in verse 4. All speak loud and clear of our measure of faith, or lack thereof, whatever the case might be. Without faith, the Christian life is a nonentity. So much is dependent upon faith. And Romans 12, 1 and 2 is dependent upon faith. And this is why Christ charged his apostles in Mark 11, verse 22, have faith in God. That's good advice. Have faith in God. I mean, there isn't any better advice than that. Have faith in God. Again, Romans 12, 1 and 2 is the way to ascertain the will of God. And we need faith to live in Romans 12, 1 and 2. It is the way to live for the honor and glory of God. And we need faith to live in verses 1 and 2. It is the way to have the most productive life. It is the way to thrive spiritually. Romans 12, 1 and 2 is the way to stay right with God. It's the way to be happy. It's the way to enjoy the Lord. But to live in verses 1 and 2 requires us to think soberly. And this is in harmony with faith. And for this reason, we must pray with the apostles in Luke 17 and verse 5, Lord, increase our faith. Lord, increase our faith. If you see tonight the need to live in Romans 12, 1 and 2, here's what you need to pray. Lord, increase my faith. Increase my faith. Because there is a direct connection between Romans 12, 1 and 2 and this measure of faith. There is a direct correlation between Romans 12, 1 and 2 and the way we think. And there is a direct connection between the way we think and faith. Lord, increase our faith. All for a faith. For a faith that goes beyond, that transcends, that is bigger than all the obstacles that stand in the way. The biggest obstacle to Romans 12, 1 and 2 is ourselves. The biggest obstacle is that intoxication with self. But even if you're able to remove that obstacle of yourself, there'll still be plenty other obstacles. And we need a faith that is bigger than all the obstacles. There are many difficulties that get in the way of Romans 12, 1 and 2. And we need a faith that is greater. We need a faith that will stand in the storm and say, as Paul said there in Acts 27, I believe God that it shall be as it was told me. I believe God. He makes twofold statement here. I believe God, and I believe what He told me, and I believe it'll be that way. A faith that believes against hope. Abraham is the example of such faith. A faith that staggered not at the promises of God, though all hope was removed. A faith that causes us to draw closer and closer and closer to the Lord. I'll tell you something about faith that'll never lead you further from God. Never. It'll always bring you closer to God. That's another test. Whether or not we're living by faith, are we drawing further from God? Or are we getting closer to the Lord? A faith that sits at Jesus' feet. A faith that enables us to put Christ first. A faith that knows whatever comes to pass, God is. God is. God is everything He says He is. A faith that cleaves to God. Faith always cleaves to God. Faith always cleaves to His Word. And faith always bows and worships the Lord. That's why we see Job there in Job chapter 1, verse 21. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's faith. That's faith. That's the kind of faith we need to live in Romans 12, 1 and 2. It is a faith that does not lose sight of the mercies of God. We can't lose sight of the mercies of God. That's our foundation. That's the foundation of Romans 12, 1 and 2. That's our motive. That's our incentive. Faith that does not lose sight of the mercies of God. A faith that is always aware, God is so good to me. God is so merciful, so gracious, so long-suffering. The least I can do is to be a sacrifice in life for Him. So we ask you tonight in closing, what is your stature of faith? And the most accurate answer to that question is answered by another question. Where are we in Romans 12, 1 and 2? And that will answer. That will answer what is our measure of faith. God's people for a long, 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 long time, probably throughout history, they think so many times, all I have to do is just make up my mind and it'll happen. That's not Bible. You need faith. You need faith. You need repentance. You need not to be intoxicated. And you think about God's people today, and there's an awful lot of drunks walking around in Baptist churches. Intoxicated with the world. Intoxicated with self. And that's dangerous. It's dangerous to you. Again, it's dangerous to everyone who's in your proximity. It's a danger. The opposite of that is to think soberly. And we do that by faith. And that faith leads us to think right. And when I'm thinking right, I know the best thing to do is to surrender to God. It's never thinking right to do that which is contrary to what God says. That's wrong thinking. That's craziness. I mean, you've lost your mind. You're nuts. You've gone berserk. It requires faith. So all that God would increase our faith. That our faith would get stronger and stronger and stronger every day. Brother Jim, if you'd come and lead us verse of song.